All right, we're continuing on our study on the English Civil War. We ended last time, kind of rushed up to the point where Charles I dissolved Parliament, and that was in 1629. And he didn't recall it again until 1640. So for some 11 years he ruled without Parliament. Oliver Cromwell had been elected to Parliament in 1628, so he'd been in a little while when it was dissolved in 1629. And then it was a long break where the members of Parliament just went back to their regular jobs, and Cromwell had a farm and stuff and did other stuff, but they went back to their regular jobs. But if you can remember, that Parliament was kind of a pressurized one, because the man who was sitting in the chair, his name was Finch. He actually becomes quite a notorious character in the whole history. But they held him down in his seat, so he couldn't adjourn. They held him in his seat, and then they passed three resolutions that were brought forward while the king was trying to, not personally, his forces were trying to get into the Parliament. They locked the door, and they couldn't get in. There were three things that they passed. The one was to condemn Popism, because Charles was trying to bring back the Roman Catholic stuff. The other was to condemn Arminianism. They kind of put those two in the same camp, Popism and Arminianism. And the third was reversing the poundage and the tonnage tax that the king had illegally introduced. So they reversed those three things. But then Parliament was then dissolved. Now those in the Church of England that desired to be more biblical in their worship, where they wanted to bring the structure and the way they worship and all that into line with God's word, kept finding themselves butting against the political and the ecclesiastical establishment, this deep rooted governmental structure, both in the church and in the state. In 1559, so we're going backwards now from the closing of Parliament, but in 1559, Queen Elizabeth had signed the Act of Uniformity, which was an attempt to unify the church's liturgy, how the worship was to take place. And so that was signed back then. And it was basically that every public worship service would follow the Book of Common Prayer. And so you were bound legally to that. And so those, obviously the name Puritan comes from those who wanted to purify the church and get it back to the true biblical sense, as opposed to the bishops and all the ceremonies and different stuff that it had. When James became king in 1603, the Puritans petitioned him to help them in purifying the church, thinking since he had come from Scotland that he would be more influenced by that, and he rejected that. He, in fact, despised the Puritans. And this group was rejected by the king. And then you had another group around that time led by William Bradford, thinking, there's no ways we're going to reform the church in England. We want to keep worshipping how we worship, so we need to leave. And some left with Bradford to Holland. It was, they believed it wasn't possible to purify the church, and so they became called the Separatists. In 1618, so they had moved to Holland and had set up and were worshipping, and that was in 1609. In 1618, the King of England sent his officers to Holland to arrest a man by the name of William Brewster, because he had published writings critical of the King of England and of the Anglican Church. So the king had his far reach into Holland and arrested Brewster. Thus, in order to distance themselves from England even more and the bad influences upon their families there in Holland, these Congregationalist families left Holland under William Bradford and set out for the New World aboard the Mayflower, thus giving birth to the Plymouth Colony in 1620. So it's all happening around that same time. So I just want to bring that in so you understand how it's tying into the States. Charles I became king in 1625, so Plymouth 1620, Charles now is king, and Parliament dissolved in 1629. The Puritans didn't like bishops, and the bishops in the Anglican Church didn't like the Puritans, and so the bishops, with the blessing of the king, sought to cleanse the church of the Puritans. So there became a real battle in the church now, and lots of persecution against the Puritans who remained in the Church of England. At this time, with the hardships economically in England, along with no chance of political influence and no freedom of worship, many people decided to restart in the New World. This was when John Winthrop, who became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630, it's when they started what would become a massive exodus of people from England. And most of these people were seeking a place where they could worship the Lord as they had, as they believed, as God had revealed it to them. Apparently, George Bush and John Kerry can trace their lineage back to John Winthrop. So he'll probably roll over in his grave. Robertson says, over the next decade, more than 20,000 religious refugees followed John Winthrop as Lord, that's Archbishop Lord, Archbishop of Canterbury, as his inquisition intensified against the Puritans, excommunicating Congregationalist ministers in England. And God did seem to favor these trips, because of the 198 ships which made the crossing carrying Puritan settlers between 1630 and 1640, only one was lost. 198 made that trip across. So in England, purging the Puritans out of the Anglican Church continued relentlessly. The court, which was called the Star Chamber, was made up of the King's Privy Council. So now we're going back 1629, 1630 in that period and on. But this court, made up of the King's Privy Council, his appointed guys, his stooges, so to speak. But this court had the authority to arrest, to torture, and to sentence indefinite imprisonments at His Majesty's pleasure if you brought about some political offense such as seditions or libel. Its punishment of Puritan propagandists was ferocious. And they did these punishments in public in London. And these were attended by Archbishop Laud himself. He had great satisfaction in observing the agonies to which he had sentenced his critics. A Puritan by the name of William Prine had his ears chopped off for a polemic against the theatre, and he was put into prison. So that was the thing, they just cut your ears off publicly. And then they still put him in prison after that. And while in prison, he wrote another paper. He doesn't learn. He wrote another paper against the bishops. And so he was arraigned again, along with a Dr. Henry Burton, who had preached a sermon attacking Archbishop Laud's innovations as being unchristian, and another man by the name of Dr. John Bastwick, who had written about the grossness and the greed of the bishops. So these three men were brought before the Star Chamber, and with Laud as the judge, they were sentenced to have their ears cut off. Pine, whose ears had already been cut off, had his stumps cut off. Whatever was left, they just hacked off. And they had to be branded on the face with a hot iron, and they were fined a massive amount of £5,000, and then they were thrown into prison for life. Now, by 1637, the king was starting to run short of money, and so adjusted a law. There was an ancient law that was carried out in England whereby every coastal county, any county that touched the coast, was responsible to pay for one ship of the navy for the king. So for their protection, because they'd realized, so that was kind of the tax. So the king would keep his fleet. But what they did, because the king needed money, his advisors sat down and they said, hey, no, we've got to make this, not every coastal county, but every county in England has to pay this tax. So they changed the law, and every in our county had to give the king a ship or the money, you know, like equivalent. I doubt they were going to make that many ships. He was going to use it for other things, but that was the pretense that they used. A man by the name of John Hampden, he resisted this. He merely had to pay 20 shillings, but on principle he refused on the grounds that while the king could declare war, it was only Parliament that was empowered to decide whether or how to raise money to fight it. So you're saying, no, you don't have authority for this. And so this man was brought before the court. It wasn't brought before the Star Chamber, it was brought before another court. It was made up of 12 judges, and they evaluated the case. And they should have quickly found him innocent, but that didn't happen. The Attorney General said, if they were to agree with John Hampden, then what would be the consequence of it but the introducing of democratical government? We can't have that. And so then the 12 judges had to give their rulings, and one of the justices said, the king may dispense with any laws in case of necessity. So that was his conclusion, so he sided with the king. Another said, the law knows no such king-yoking policy. The law is of itself an old and trusty servant of the king's. It is his instrument. It is common and most true that rex is lex, the king is law. The king cannot do wrong. So that was his ruling. So he sided with the king. Three more judges sided with the king. So there were like five judges now sided with the king. The sixth judge to give his ruling was George Croke, a closet Puritan. And he upheld the idea that there could be no taxation without representation. He said, ship money, it was called ship money, this, you know, where each county had to pay for a ship. But he said, ship money was in reality a tax for which the common law required parliamentary authorization. No claim by the king of necessity or danger could override this inflexible rule. And so he ruled on side of the commoner. And then four more judges then followed Croke, and so you had a five to five at this stage. Yeah, it was five and five. Whatever. Anyway, it came down to the final judge, who was this Finch, and who was held down, and he was the judge who was going to be ruling. And he ruled on the king's behalf and thus gave the victory to the king. But his ruling was, the king had unlimited discretion to act for what, in his unchallengeable subjective view, was the public good. His good faith had to be assumed on the question of whether the king was in the kingdom was in danger. So we just have to trust the king. And Robertson says that the judges who ruled in favor of the king, saying that, said about them, he said that their ambition to be grandees at court had caused them to betray their trust as guardians of the people's liberty. And they did this by acting as tools of the government and overextending the royal prerogative. So their desire for position made them blind to their responsibilities. So the narrow victory that the king gained, 7-5 ultimately, sent the message to the people in the nation that the ship tax was in truth unlawful. They picked up on this and they said, five honorable judges that they deemed honorable had ruled against it, and they said that has to carry somewhere. There has to be something going on. And so a lot of people stopped paying the ship tax. And as Robertson says, England was now in the grip of widespread civil disobedience. Finch, that final judge who ruled and gave the victory to the king, then wrote to all the judges in the country saying, my lords, it is your part to break the insolence of the vulgar before it approaches too nigh the royal throne. He realized there's a threat here. If the people start resisting this, we have a problem. And so he was pleading with the judges to deal ruthlessly with anyone who wouldn't pay. Charles then, as fools do, decided to take on Scotland, to undermine the Scottish Church. Some have suggested it's because he hated Calvinism. His Archbishop Laud hated Calvinism, was an Arminian, hated the Scottish independence and stuff like that. And so Charles, and I think you get full of yourself, you think you're invincible, and so he turned his attention to Scotland to bring the church under control. And he tried to impose upon Scotland the equivalent of the Common Book of Prayer. It kind of made it a little bit Scottish. But it was, in the sense, that's what he was doing. The Scottish Church, as they saw this thing heading their way, him putting together this team to write this book, that's when they drew up the National Covenant in Scotland. And they made this National Covenant early in 1638. So when this liturgy was then imposed on Scotland later on in 1638, after this National Covenant had been drawn up, the Scots rioted in Edinburgh, and then this rioting spread to other areas. And the National Covenant, the Scottish people rallied around and reaffirmed the National Covenant, which included a pledge to maintain the authority of parliaments, both the Scottish and the English Parliament. That was part of the National Covenant. We're going to maintain the parliaments. Without which neither any laws nor lawful judications can be established. That's what the Solemn League, the National Covenant, stated. So without Parliament, we can't have any laws, and we can't even adjudicate any laws. And so at that time as well, after this liturgy was forced upon them, the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland then met and condemned the new prayer book. It abolished episcopal church government by bishops, and it adopted Presbyterian church government by elders and deacons. Charles reacted strongly and said, "I will rather die than yield to these impertinent and damnable divines." And in anger, he made a rash plan to reduce that people to obedience by force. And so now this, he's got his little feathers ruffled, and he wants to take on Scotland. But without Parliament's authority and without money, the king had to put together a force himself. And by April 1639, he had done this, and he marched against Scotland. This is called the First Bishop's War. So he's taking his troops to squash Scotland because the church refuses to adopt the Book of Prayer. The Scots, however, had put together a far superior army and marched under the banner of For Christ's Crown and Covenant. And Charles, when he saw the Scottish forces, he immediately realized, I'm done for. There's nothing I can do about this. And so he, without a shot being fired, he entered into a peace treaty. And his treaty was, he agreed with the Scots, promising that before imposing uniformity of worship, he would consult with the Scottish Parliament and the National Assembly of the Kirk. He had no intention of ever keeping this, but in good faith, they received it and went their ways. Charles returned to England very angry and vengeful, to London. And he determined to raise forces immediately to destroy the Scots. He was going to go back and kill them. It was for this purpose that he called a man, Thomas Wentworth, who was his governor in Ireland. He had appointed him as governor in Ireland. He called this man to come back to help him, give him advice with respect to raising an army, how he could fund it and go back to Scotland. And so in September 1640, this man Wentworth came and to advise the king. And he advised the king to raise a superior force and reduce Scotland to the status of a colony. Wentworth had been in the previous parliament back in 1628, and so he knew a lot of the parliamentarians, but he had turned into a stooge of the king now. But he advised the king, let's do it, let's raise the money. And he suggested to the king, recall parliament and we'll get the money. He was completely disconnected with reality. It's hard to believe that the king and this man Wentworth could be so disconnected from what was the feeling on the ground, what was the feeling amongst the Puritans, what was the feelings amongst ex-parliamentarians, that they would have even thought about, let's call Parliament. It's almost surreal, like our days, where people are so disconnected with reality of what people are thinking or what's going on. And so they said, we'll just recall Parliament and get the funds for the war. And now Wentworth, who the king had made Earl of Strafford, opened Parliament, praising the king and demanding money to pay for the war against the treasonable Scots. The House, after his opening address, the House proceeded over the next 3 weeks to lambaste the evils perpetrated by the government. They just were just condemning all these things. Wentworth advised the king to dissolve Parliament, which was done. And this was known as the Short Parliament because it sat for kind of less than a month. My first Short Parliament, I wondered, you got a long Parliament and a Short Parliament. I wasn't sure if the buildings were kind of changed. And as they closed Parliament, the King's Privy Council then imprisoned some MPs and they searched the homes and offices of some of the Puritan leaders. And so there's just harassment going on. Charles then called his cabinet together for a council of war with Scotland. Wentworth, or Stafford as he's also called, was the war's leading proponent, urging a forced loan from the City of London to fund it. Wentworth said that this was a case of necessity and necessity knew no law. The king was loose and absolved from all rules of government. An army was raised and marched on Scotland in August, but it ended the same month because the Scots invaded England and routed Charles's army. He was forced to sign another peace, terms of which included the Scottish army remaining in England until Charles recalled Parliament in order to get the necessary funds to pay the Scots for their trouble. So they inhabited England and waited for the funds to come. Charles had no alternative and recalled Parliament, and this became known as the Long Parliament because it would sit without interruption for the next 13 years. So the Parliament first met in November 1640, and its first act was to impeach the Earl of Strafford, Wentworth, for high treason. The Earl was the second most powerful person in the country. He was arrested and placed in the Tower. A little later, he was joined in the Tower by the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Lord, also for treason. Finch, the judge and the notorious Cheshireter, was arrested after several of the ship's money judges testified that he had improperly pressurized them into supporting the king in their rulings. Finch, however, managed to escape with the king's permission to France. Parliament also forced the release of the Puritan martyrs, as they called them. Prynne, Burton and Bestwick had their ears cut off and faces branded, had them released from prison, and they returned to London apparently with this most incredible triumphal parade. There was just like thousands of carriages and horses, and it was an amazing spectacle. Strafford's charges were that he had advised the king to wage war on the Scots and to bring the Irish army to the mainland to reduce this kingdom. Okay, so they're saying that's treason. According to the Inns, those are the places of where the lawyers and the barristers studied and held their seats. According to the Inns in England, the most serious aspect of Strafford's actions was him subverting law by making it subservient to the power of the king rather than Parliament. In all treason, there must either be some hostility to the king or some intention to destroy the state. Ultimately, they were going about this according to the legal way, and it turned out that it was dragging on and dragging on because they didn't quite have enough evidence to prove the conviction, apparently, of the Earl of Strafford. And so a bill was introduced into Parliament for the attainder of the Earl of Strafford. The attainder is a legal consequence of judgment. It's a judgment of death, and it can be carried out for treason, and it involves the loss of all civil liberties. So this is kind of a legal way of going around something. Now, if both houses, this bill was introduced, and if both houses agreed to this, it would then be put before the king, who would need to sign it, and it would become law. And then Strafford would die. And the reasoning is Parliament was the highest court in the country and could ordain death by statute and without trial, and this was subject only to the king, the king's approval. But actually, Parliament was widening the legal definition of treason. Up to this point, treason was a crime involving denial of allegiance to the king. And it also included political attacks on his realm by subverting the laws or abusing delegated powers. This extended definition would lead open the possibility that was unforeseen at the moment. It would open the possibility that treason might be committed by a king who attacked another sovereign institution, i.e. parliament. And so suddenly the definition of treason had been widened. Nobody realized it at the time, but in fact, this is what had happened. The bill passed both houses, and the king, shortly before it passed, assured Strafford with a solemn promise that, upon the word of a king, you shall not suffer in life, honor, or fortune. 2 weeks later, the king signed the bill. And on hearing the news, Strafford famously spluttered, "Put not your trust in princes." And 100,000 people showed up for the beheading of Strafford. The mistake that the Stuart kings, that's Charles and that line, their mistake was to perceive the Puritans as bent on destruction of monarchy and therefore as a movement to be suppressed. But there is no evidence up until 1641, after all of these proceedings, that any Puritan leader had that as an intention. We've got to get rid of the king. There was never that thinking. No Puritan leader envisaged anything like a republic at that stage. As we conclude, the young barrister who we'll get to know better, John Cook, he had actually defended Strafford and was incredibly courageous to take on that position, because 100,000 showing up to the execution proved how hated this man was in England. And he stood and defended this man just for a legal purpose. But Robertson says, this young man realized at this time that in the way people were thinking about the law and treason and the king, that if that thinking was truly followed, they could not have executed Strafford, because it was impossible to convict the king's deputy with treason. Because this young man reasoned, he said, the king's deputy, acting with royal approval, could not be convicted of a crime of disloyalty to the king. So he's saying their concept, the concept in the minds of most people up to that time, actually, I'm not saying they shouldn't have executed Strafford, I'm just saying that their understanding of the king up to that point meant that they shouldn't have executed Strafford, because they were all sidestepping the king. They were pointing and arresting his deputies, staying away from the awkward question of, well, what about the king? And they hadn't yet addressed that. But as Robertson points out, this barrister must have realized, or he's claiming he did realize, he couldn't be executed of disloyalty to the king because the king could do no wrong. And because the wrong in such circumstances should be attributed directly to the king if the king approved. And so that was his reasoning. And so that's, John Cook becomes the young man that is going to be thrust into an incredible position in the future. But this would have been important to his thinking, as he now was going to deal later on with the whole legal matter with the king himself. So we see this is progressing. I hope it's not going too slowly for you, but it seemed that there's just too much to skim over that to try and fill it out. And so although these people have been arrested, the king is still around, and now we will see the king's actions becoming more and more treasonous as he starts to try and regain ground that he has lost with Parliament.